Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in History. I'm Marshall Poe, your host. Each week we pick a history book that we find particularly interesting, and we interview the author of that book. This week we're happy to have Howard Jones on the show. We'll be talking about his new book, The Bay of Pigs. It's recently appeared from Oxford University Press. The book is very timely. We Americans find ourselves embroiled in another foreign adventure. And Professor Jones does an excellent job of explaining how we've been there before. In this instance, how three successive American administrations, the Eisenhower, Kennedy, and Johnson administrations, really couldn't let go of the idea that Fidel Castro had to be gotten rid of by any means necessary, and I mean any means necessary. I really enjoyed my conversation with Howard today, and I hope that you enjoy the interview. Here it is. Hi, Howard.
Hi, Marshall. How are you doing today?
I'm very well. It's actually quite a beautiful day here in Iowa. How is it down in Alabama?
It is gorgeous here, even though we're getting ready for a couple of tropical storms to whip through.
Yeah, that's what I hear. I should actually call, as I told you in the pre-interview, my sister and brother-in-law and her family and my mother and stepfather all live down in Alabama, and I was actually born there, believe it or not.
Oh, well, I didn't know that.
Yeah, my father was in the Army at Redstone Arsenal.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, with Werner von Braun.
Where is your family now?
Well, they're still in Huntsville, or in a place called Madison, I think. I don't know. It's a suburb of Huntsville. I don't know very much about it, to be honest with you. But I thought that's kind of an interesting connection.
Yes.
Anyway, let me tell the listeners that today we're talking with Howard Jones on the show about his really terrific new book, The Bay of Pigs. And again, to tip my hand. I thought it was it's a really terrific book, and it will amaze you.
I can hardly
believe my own government did these things. I'm just so resistant to thinking that they did, but they did,
and you
show it very well. But why don't we begin by having you tell us a little bit about yourself? That is, where you were born, and you know where you grew up, and how you became interested in history and that sort of thing.
Well, I was actually born in Lebanon, Tennessee, but I don't remember much about that because my father took a job in Gary, Indiana to work at the steel mills, and I moved north to Gary when I was about 6 weeks old, so very young, and we returned every summer for vacations. But I went to school at Indiana University in Bloomington, got my undergraduate and graduate degrees there. And my first teaching position, actually in the meantime, was in a high school at Gary Lee Wallace. And then in the fall of 1972, I took a position at the University of Nebraska, where I taught 2 years. They were each one-year positions. Then in 1974, I got the job here at the University of Alabama in Tuscaloosa. I've been very happy here.
Well, that's excellent. Yeah, no, I moved away from Alabama when I was very young as well. I think I was 4 at the time and don't remember it. But all of my family has returned there after a long jaunt in Kansas. So it's a really terrific place. So how did you become interested in American history? You study modern American, I guess we would call it political history. How did you become interested in this?
My first teaching position in high school was 11th grade U.S. history, so that became my natural interest. But my interest in history actually began with, believe it or not, a football coach who taught it at Edison High School.
Mm-hmm.
And we talked mostly football in class, as you can perhaps imagine.
We
got in a little bit of history, just enough to pique my interest. And then when I went to undergraduate school at IU, I did like many undergraduates, which is I probably had at least a half a dozen majors before I really knew what I was going to do.
Mm-hmm.
And then one day I had a class that began with an elderly man named R. Carlisle Bewley, who had won a Pulitzer for a book on the opening of the Old Midwest, and he just was an inspiration from day one.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what it was about him, but it was just something that told me I want to do that. And so I fortunately met up with a man at Indiana University for my graduate degree, actually two, Robert Farrell in diplomatic history and Maurice Baxter in constitutional history. And both of them had a great deal of interest in Daniel Webster and a lot of things relating to foreign as well as domestic policy, and they sparked my interest in going on in what turned out to be diplomatic history. And so my first book was actually my dissertation revised at the University of North Carolina, and it was on the Webster-Ashburton Treaty of 1842. And I probably knew next to nothing about the topic until one day I was sitting in the office with Professor Farrell. I had just passed my exams, and I said, I don't know what I want to work on for my dissertation. And he dug out his textbook and began leafing through the chapters. And he said, well, no, there's a book on this. No, there's a book on, oh, there's the Webster-Ashburton Treaty. That would be, and I remember this so well, a teach of a topic. And I, of course, nodded and looked excited and so forth. And as soon as I left his office, I ran to, I don't know, a history book, encyclopedia, or somewhere to find out what the Webster-Ashburton Treaty was. I really didn't know. And I had taught high school for 6 years, but I don't remember ever mentioning it. Well, I found out, to make a long story short, that it involved a boundary dispute, which is not exactly exciting, but it turned out to be, to me, interesting. And there was a murder, and there were raids on the borders and so forth. And it was a lot of fun when I got into it, and that turned out to be my first book. So I then went from that to writing a textbook, and probably too young in my career to do that, but I tackled it. And then I turned to the book that I really had. I was just amazed at what I got into, the Amistad Revolt of 1839, and I called it Mutiny on the Amistad, and it was later made into a movie, the story was, and my book was used in by Steven Spielberg in writing the screenplay and so forth. But that was my first book with Oxford University Press, and I remember that I circulated a prospectus, like all authors do, to several publishers, and no one was really interested. And someone said, well, if you send a chapter or two, well, I hadn't begun any kind of writing on it, and I remember so well that I sent it to Oxford University Press, and the editors there within 2 weeks had a contract. They knew what the topic was. They offered me a contract.
That's great.
I was off.
That's really
so. Go ahead.
Yeah, obviously, that's a good experience with the press, because oftentimes experience with presses are not so good.
That is true. It was a wonderful experience, and this was in the mid '80s when computers were first kind of coming into the among historians, and I was a dinosaur, and I wasn't going to get involved in that. And a friend of me happened to be in town and almost forced me down to a computer dealer. And we bought a state-of-the-art, my wife gave me approval, state-of-the-art Apple IIe dot matrix. Dating myself.
Yeah, I remember those,
But what a revelation it was.
Right.
And that was the key to my career.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
No.
That's funny. And then how did you get into modern U.S. diplomatic history?
Well, the nice thing about diplomatic history is you have the whole landscape. You can start with the Revolution and go all the way to the present. And I tended to, my interests tend to shift. I will do something in the 19th century, and then after I've done that, I will sometimes shift to the 20th mm-hmm. and then back and so forth. So my first book in the 20th century was a book on the Truman Doctrine.
Mm-hmm.
And then I did a couple of books on Lincoln and the Civil War. And then I came back, among others, I did a book on John F. Kennedy and the Vietnam War.
Mm-hmm.
And then I got interested in
I was going to say, if you could just interrupt you for a second so our readers
sure.
know, that book on Kennedy got quite a lot of press, if I remember.
Yeah, well, I appreciate that.
It did, though. I mean, it did, don't be too modest now. It got a lot of press.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I went into that. I'm not a Kennedy apologist by any means, and I think that comes out very clearly, at least I hope, in the book on the Bay of Pigs.
It definitely does.
I didn't know what I was too subtle in the book.
No, not at all.
Okay. But I went into the Kennedy-Vietnam question wondering if Oliver Stone and the various others were correct about whether he had some kind of exit strategy in mind. Was he going to take us deeper into the war and so forth? And I was just amazed at how collected he was in dealing with the Vietnam War, how careful he was, and how many questions, the hard questions, that the president, I think, must ask himself and his advisors before stepping into the great abyss of intervention in some foreign country.
Yeah.
And Kennedy asked what appeared to me to be the right questions. And he concluded that it was not the correct thing to go deeper into Vietnam.
Uh-huh.
And documents that came out much longer after the fact indicated that he had set in motion through McNamara the idea of drafting a plan of withdrawal.
Mm-hmm.
Really a Soviet withdrawal that was mm-hmm. really the basis for Vietnamization later, mm-hmm. although he didn't call it that at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea was that beginning in December of 63, over the course of the next year, the U.S. would actually turn the clock back to where it was when he first became president,
mm-hmm.
which meant that there would be advisors there and the whole special contingent of Green Berets and various other so-called advisors, 15, 16, 17,000 of them,
mm-hmm.
would withdraw, and we would be back to where we were before.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, he was assassinated.
Mm-hmm.
How was that book received? I know the answer to this, but why don't you talk a little bit
about it? Well, it got a mixed response. Some put me in the category of an Oliver Stone apologist, which I am not. I mean, there's just no way. I firmly believe that you take the documents and you let the documents tell the story. And you add a few comments here and there, you
yeah.
make the transitions, but you really stay true to the documents.
Uh-huh.
That doesn't mean they're right all the time.
Right.
But anyway, that's where I tried to stay. And that's mm-hmm. where the story took me.
Yeah. No, it's interesting. I remember I was actually, what year was it published?
That was published in 2003.
Yeah, I was working in Washington at a magazine, and
it was discussed there. Yeah,
really?
But yeah, no, it was, you know, it's interesting because I think one thing that made the topic more difficult for you, it's a terrific topic, was in fact Oliver Stone and these people who are, let's just say they're not historians. I don't want to mm-hmm. call them cranks, but when they say things, it tends to kind of cast them in doubt. So
mm-hmm.
anytime they make an assertion of any sort, immediately people begin to doubt it.
Yes.
And he had said that Kennedy wanted to get us out. And so I think that people thought, well, that's just Oliver Stone being sort of crazy.
Mm-hmm.
But no, I thought it was brave of you to take the topic up, and certainly it's a good historical demonstration. And as I say, I think that's why it made it made the kind of waves that it did. So I think it's an important example of how historians can carefully pick a good topic and then kind of shape public discourse about something. Because as we'll say in a moment, you're absolutely right. You are no apologist for the Kennedys. That's totally
well,
true.
I appreciate
yeah.
that. I really
yeah.
do. You know, it still has repercussions today. I sometimes will follow blogs to see what's mm-hmm. been said about the Bay of Pigs book and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a couple, I didn't, but on a blog, someone wrote in and said, I'm not going to read this book on the Bay of Pigs. Mm-hmm. He's a JFK apologist mm-hmm. and remember his book on Kennedy yeah. and so forth and so on. And I'm certainly not that.
Yeah, that's a person who doesn't read.
That's
what you ran into. Yeah, that's not a reader. That's somebody who talks about reading.
Yes,
and they're different things. So let's turn directly to the Bay of Pigs. How did you have the opportunity to write this book?
Well, I've always been interested, which is pretty obvious, I think, now, in the Kennedy period, in this period of the 1960s, a tumultuous time. I was in college at the time and missed a lot of it because I was deeply involved in the library, as you mm-hmm. can well imagine. But I've always been interested in that, and, of course, I have this kind of almost morbid interest, as I think a lot of people do, judging by books that are at the tops of the New York Times list, the mob, the mafia, mm-hmm. the underworld, the syndicate, and so forth and mm-hmm. so on. And I had heard about the attempt to kill Castro.
Mm-hmm.
I had heard about the CIA actually partnering with the mafia to
mm-hmm.
find Cuban dissidents who are willing to kill Castro. And I found that really hard to believe.
Yeah.
I didn't. Yeah, it really was something. And so I decided I would investigate that. I set forth a proposal to Oxford
yeah.
on writing a book on the Bay of Pigs for the Pivotal Moments in American History series.
Uh-huh.
In my proposal, when I look back over it, I didn't have anything about the mafia.
Uh-huh.
I talked about the actual Bay of Pigs fiasco itself, and that was what got me the contract.
Uh-huh.
And when I got into it, the word assassination came up over and over. The mafia's name came up over and over.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was fortunate in that the National Archives had just released a large number of documents from the CIA. They were in a special place in College Park, Maryland, and
mm-hmm.
I got into those, and the whole thing began to just tell itself. And then I combined that with something that everyone knows about, but I'm not sure everyone has read very carefully, and that's the Church Committee transcript.
Right.
Thousands of pages of transcripts of interviews of people such as John Roselli from the mafia.
Mm-hmm.
And Sam Giancana from the mafia was on the ticket to be interviewed one day, but he was killed the night before.
Right, yeah.
And
wow.
Six times around the mouth, indicating a signal that he talked a bit too much.
Yeah.
And then John Roselli testified three times in great detail, and then shortly thereafter they found him in a barrel off Florida.
Right, yeah. That's a remarkable story. I mean, that in and of itself. So maybe we could just set the scene a little bit. Tell us a little bit about, let's just go through the Bay of Pigs itself. Tell us a little bit about the Cuban Revolution and the American reaction to it.
Well, the U.S., through the Eisenhower administration, through the Cold War 50s, had virtually allied with Batista, the dictator of Cuba.
Uh-huh.
And if you actually go back farther than that, the mob, the Sicilian mob, the underworld and so forth, had set itself up in Cuba, very closely tied with Batista. And then the Eisenhower administration ended up using the mutual security program to funnel in all kinds of aid to Batista to really hold up his regime.
Mm-hmm.
And you can look at economic interests and strategic interests and political interests and all this kind of thing. But what was festering beneath the surface was a great deal of unhappiness with Batista, a lot of people who were suffering. There was a lot of people who were doing well, but a lot of people were suffering. And out of this came a young charismatic lawyer out of the University of Havana, a man named Fidel Castro,
mm-hmm.
his brother Raul, and the famed guerrilla leader of Latin America, Che Guevara.
Mm-hmm.
And they started out with a small band of rebels and were knocked down several times. And then finally, by January 1st, 1959, he was able to amass enough of a rebel force to force Batista out to go into exile, and he had control of Cuba.
Mm-hmm. Now, he wasn't a communist at the time, is that
no,
correct?
No,
not at all.
I think
yeah.
that's as clear as you could make it during this time. I think that's very clear. But what horrified Americans was that when he came in, he first theatrically and almost hysterically entered into several 6 and 7 hour long just diatribes, and people wondered about what kind of bladder does this man have and so forth, that he could speak for so long and just hysterically attack the United States, which of course solidifies his rule at home. There's mm-hmm. no question about that.
Right.
But he talked about Guantanamo, and this just shook the rafters of the American security establishment, as one can well imagine. And he went on, and then he expropriated American business interests on the island. Mm-hmm. A large number of companies, 30 or 40, that were owned by and operated by Americans were taken, and Cuba now had them.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, this just the Eisenhower administration didn't know what to do at this point, and Richard Nixon ended up having a three-hour interview with Castro and concluded that he was a communist in the making.
Mm-hmm.
And the administration decided that first thing we need to do is to not overthrow him, to undermine his credibility. Mm-hmm. That was the first step. And so the CIA came up with some ideas like aerosol spray in the radio stations that would make the speakers look delirious and so forth and so on. And then they were going to put some kind of salt in his boots, and then this would make his facial hair fall out.
Mm-hmm.
And the bearded one, who mm-hmm. was a macho man, would no longer have facial hair.
Mm-hmm.
And it went on and on. And then finally the whole plan evolved into killing him.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the word killing wasn't used. Assassination wasn't used. The word elimination was used.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, of course, a euphemism that is part of this whole idea of plausible deniability, that you've
mm-hmm.
got to have a way to deny that you are actually involved. You don't lead a trail of written evidence or anything of the sort.
Mm-hmm.
And this was a strategy that had been stated at one time by Alan Dulles, the legendary director of the CIA, who was already 2 for 2 in Guatemala and
right.
Iran.
Mm-hmm.
And now he tells President Eisenhower, and then he tells Kennedy when he comes in trying to argue for the overthrow plan, that this plan is even better than the ones that worked before in
mm-hmm.
Guatemala.
Mm-hmm.
And the plan was that we need to overthrow the Cuban regime, Castro regime, and what comes out of this is assassinating Castro as the spark that would ignite a massive popular insurrection, which was considered to be the key to success in overthrowing him.
Mm-hmm.
And so now, how do you kill him?
Yeah, so if I could just stop you for a moment.
Sure.
Because this is a question I had in the book, and you answer it, but just let me, I'd like to hear you talk a little about it. They really fixated on this idea that there would be a relationship between the elimination of Castro and the fall of the Castro regime.
Mm-hmm.
That one would lead to the other.
Mm-hmm.
Why did they do this? Why did they think that eliminating Castro would eliminate the Castro regime?
They were hoping that, first they believed that there was just a massive number of dissidents in Cuba who were just waiting for something to happen, some signal from somewhere that would get everything rolling.
Was there any evidence of that at all?
No.
Yeah, that's the thing I never heard.
The CIA did not have the evidence, but it had been invincible. That was the image that people had at the time. Alan Dulles was a legend in his own time. Richard Bissell was the man put in charge of black operations in the CIA, and he had been the person who had helped Alan Dulles develop the U-2 spy operation, the reconnaissance plane,
uh-huh.
and he was called the most brilliant man in all Washington.
Mm-hmm.
But he had not a lick of common sense.
Yeah, apparently not.
He knew economics forward and backward. He was a Yale University PhD and college professor of economics.
Uh-huh.
But how this translates into expertise in covert operations
yeah.
is beyond me.
Yeah, me too.
I don't understand any connection. But Richard Bissell said over and over, and he was a very cold, methodical, tall, overbearing kind of person who was so sure of himself that no one could question him.
Yeah.
And he said, this will work. We are going to recruit the mafia to find Cuban dissidents, and we're going to assassinate Castro as the spark to a revolution. And in fact, if we kill him, the actual invasion might not have to take place.
Right. So does Eisenhower sign off on this?
He signs off on the overall invasion plan, and we have it, I think, from several reliable sources that he knew that assassination was part of the plan, but under plausible deniability. You never use the word in a cabinet meeting, a national security meeting. You never put it on paper, but you use euphemisms like remove and eliminate and kick out and various other things, but never the word assassination.
I see. So then this thing cooks and cooks for a while, and it gets passed off to the Kennedy administration. How does that happen?
When Kennedy first was nominated, and it was clear he was going to get the nomination, and then when he went on and won the election, and there was this period in between before he actually is inaugurated, there was a big briefing session in West Palm Beach, and there was Alan Dulles, and there was Richard Bissell. And they talked with Kennedy numerous times about various things, as you can well imagine.
Mm-hmm.
And there was one instance in which Alan Dulles and JFK went off by themselves totally, and Bissell was not part of it.
Mm-hmm.
And Bissell thinks that in this period, he might have told the president, the president-elect, what was in the making. But he certainly knew about the overthrow plan of Castro. But whether he knew about the actual assassination aspect, that is the real question. Bissell thinks, when I looked at some of the things he said, that he didn't tell him anything about it until he became president. But mm-hmm. he might have said something in that private conversation, but he just doesn't know.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the reason why I think you can tie a lot of this together is, first, Alan Dulles was the director of the CIA, who is the direct liaison with the president, and I cannot, in any stretch of the imagination, imagine that Alan Dulles would act on his own mm-hmm. if he is directly responsible to the president without telling the president in some way, maybe not using the word assassination, but a nod, a wink, a shrugging of the shoulders at mm-hmm. the right time, some kind of euphemism or whatever, that this is in the making.
Mm-hmm.
And another thing, two other things that tell me this, is that, as you know, just about a year or so ago, the family jewels
mm-hmm.
were published,
that's right,
released by the CIA,
mm-hmm.
and there, for the first time, publicly and explicitly, Alan Dulles admits that he approved of the assassination plan.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And the other point is that McGeorge Bundy, who is the president's national security advisor, within 1 week of the president being in office, he is talking by phone with Richard Bissell and the CIA about establishing an actual program
mm-hmm.
of assassination, an executive action
mm-hmm.
capability
mm-hmm.
within the CIA to take care of, to eliminate not only Castro, but Noden Diem,
mm-hmm.
Rafael Trujillo of
mm-hmm.
the Dominican Republic,
mm-hmm.
Patrice Lumumba of Africa,
mm-hmm.
and any other troublesome foreign state leaders.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So tell us a little bit about the assassination attempts on Castro himself. He was a very lucky man.
Oh, according to some, over the course of his time, now if you throw in everyone who was involved from the Cuban side as well as our attempts here, there were over 600 attempts to bring him down.
Yeah, very lucky man.
Over 600. Yeah. And we know that there were at least six major attempts that were concocted by the CIA in collaboration with either the mafia or just on its own.
Mm-hmm.
There were two major attempts involving the CIA. Both of them were poison attempts. The CIA actually recommended gangland slaying, an actual mob wipeout.
Mm-hmm.
They were going to kill not only Fidel, but Raul and Che Guevara as
mm-hmm.
well.
Mm-hmm.
And the various strategists said it simply can't work. How can you get all three of them together? And Sam Giancana, who was the godfather from Chicago, the godfather of the CIA, along with Santo Trafficante, who was the godfather from the South out of Tampa, Florida, and the real liaison between the CIA and the mafia was John Roselli, who's a sparkling personality, who brought in Giancana and Trafficante. And when they're meeting with the CIA and the idea came up for gangland slaying, they looked at the emissary with disbelief that who is going to ever want to walk up to Castro and kill him for money knowing he could never escape?
Right.
And so the idea was born of poison.
Yeah.
And so the CIA concocted some kind of pill that contained some poison that if you drop it into food or into the water or into the drink or a shake or whatever it may be and Castro consumes it, that it'll be a slow-acting poison and it will look like he died of natural causes.
Mm-hmm.
In the meantime, the culprit will have escaped. Well, this then caused a big problem. Who do you get who is close enough to Castro who can do that? And so they came up with this guy named Juan Orta, who hated Castro because he had been part of those getting kickbacks from the casinos and all of that kind of thing before Castro came in. He lost his big income. But he had nevertheless appeared loyal, and he was right there as more or less a private secretary of Castro, and he could drop the pills into the poison or into the water or whatever else Castro might have. Well, he got cold feet, according to more than one person, and thought he had been found out, and he ran away and escaped into the Mexican embassy, and the poison plot failed. And that was on the eve of the invasion. And a year later, they tried again, and that didn't work either.
Mm-hmm.
I see. So let's talk a little bit about the invasion itself. Who were the? When did the idea of actually recruiting Cubans to go invade Cuba, when was it created?
Well, the plan itself, the covert action plan, was formally approved by President Eisenhower in March 17th of 1960. All before Kennedy.
Yeah.
All before Kennedy.
And had the training bases in, was it Guatemala, been set up at that time?
They went ahead and set them up in Guatemala, sent special forces there to train them, recruited Air National Guard pilots out of Birmingham, Alabama. And they were on the secret mission to train the pilots in flying B-26s and various other planes, but these were the big ones. And they were going to provide ground support with bombing and strafing of the Cuban brigade as they hit the beaches in Cuba.
And how did they recruit the Cubans who were involved in the brigade?
It was supposed to be a secret thing, but I think everybody, except perhaps me, knew about it at the time. It was one of the most open secrets that one can imagine. The Guatemalan president was asked in press conferences. He, of course, vehemently denied this taking place in his own country. There were people who were on trains, and the trains would stop to pick up water or whatever, and they were right there in the countryside of Guatemala, and people would get off and walk around and watch them training in Guatemala, in the backsides, and various other places as well. And the Soviets knew all about it, and the Soviets informed Castro a month or so before this happened, that on April 17th there's going to be the invasion.
Yeah.
They knew the date, they knew everything.
Yeah, if I recall,
and Kennedy.
Yeah, if I recall correctly, it even appeared in major American newspapers that this was about to happen.
Well, Kennedy later, when some of this came out in the newspapers, threw down the papers with disgust, and he said that Castro doesn't need any spies. All he has to do is read America's newspapers.
Yeah. So not so covert. So I guess, answer me this. It's not something I wasn't aware that the CIA was in the business of training military forces for invading other countries. How did they get in this business?
They roughhouse themselves into that position. That's the only thing I can say, because at one pivotal moment in the discussion of what was to happen, first, it was to be an infiltration. It was to be a small-scale operation. There would be small guerrilla teams, half a dozen or so in each team, which would quietly infiltrate the island. Mm-hmm. And they would set up connection, a network of connections with the Cuban dissidents, with the guerrillas in the Escambray Mountains and so forth. And then this would be the key to this massive insurrection. Well, when they got together with the first 30 or 40, someone got the idea that this is not really enough. So there were recruitments in Miami and recruitments, of course, in Cuba and so forth, and the number began to grow just like Topsy.
Mm-hmm.
It just grew and grew until it grew to well over 1,500,
mm-hmm.
and they became known as the Cuban Brigade.
Mm-hmm.
Well, in the course of all of this, this small-scale guerrilla covert operation that the CIA was totally in charge of morphed into something that became an amphibious invasion.
Yeah.
And this was something that even the World War II strategists had great struggles with, and yet the CIA was now having this in its domain.
Yeah.
And the Joint Chiefs of Staff were involved in this to the point of their being observers. And there was one famous facial encounter between, and I would bet it was Bissell and perhaps the Joint Chiefs of Staff, who just simply told the Joint Chiefs, "You butt out of this.
Mm-hmm.
This is our business. It's been given to us by the president. You will have no role in this."
Mm-hmm.
And so the military experts in something that had become a military invasion were shut out.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But
Kennedy's still going to them for some advice, isn't he, as the plan is presented by the CIA when he comes into office?
Yes, he is. Kennedy, keep in mind, was the youngest president ever elected to office.
Uh-huh.
He was enamored of the so-called experts, the
yeah.
CIA, which had never lost, and the Joint Chiefs of Staff, which had this kind of an aura around him, as you can imagine.
Yeah.
And he tended to listen to these people.
Mm-hmm.
There's just no question. And the Joint Chiefs never voiced any real concern about the plan.
Mm-hmm.
And Kennedy took their silence as tacit approval.
Mm-hmm.
And later on, he had a famous encounter with the head, with one of the Joint Chiefs, in which he said that we had a meeting about this, and I never heard from you. And he told the president that I really objected to this plan, but everyone was in favor of it, so I didn't say anything.
Mm-hmm.
And Kennedy said, "Don't you realize that when I float a plan and no one voices any kind of criticism of it, I assume that means approval."
Mm-hmm.
And here they went round and round. "No, we didn't mean that, but you didn't tell me." And what happened was it's a failure by his advisors. Richard Bissell knew the flaws in the plan. There's no question about it,
mm-hmm.
but he didn't tell the president about it.
Mm-hmm.
He led them. He led the president to believe that when the invasion plan was changed from Trinidad to the Bay of Pigs,
mm-hmm.
this placed the Bay of Pigs 80 miles from the Escambray Mountains.
Mm-hmm.
And in between the Escambray Mountains and the beaches themselves was 1 million square miles
mm-hmm.
of swamp,
mm-hmm.
the Pot of Swamp, full of every creature one
yeah.
can ever imagine.
Yeah.
And he had he led the president to believe that there was not that distance, that it was safe, and that they could easily escape in the mountains if things didn't go well on the
mm-hmm.
beaches.
Is this the era in which the notion of plausible deniability, which is a strange locution if you think about it, is this the era in which it becomes kind of a known entity or a cliche in government circles?
I think so. I think this probably more than anything advertised what the strategy of the CIA was. Alan Dulles had stated this publicly at one time, or at least he was on record as having stated the way that it was supposed to work. And I think probably the Bay of Pigs, more than anything else, just advertised plausible deniability.
Yeah.
I think that more than anything else, what forced Kennedy to make two absolutely critical decisions that I think more than anything else brought the plan down. One was that he stopped the air cover for the actual
yeah.
invasion. He
yeah.
called it off because he was afraid that this would expose the American hand.
Yeah, well, he moved the location of the invasion itself in order to do this, and I guess that's something that I found. I teach a class in military history, and you know, it really wouldn't matter whether you invaded in sort of Normandy or Brest. I mean, the Germans would have known you're coming.
Mm-hmm.
So switching from Trinidad to where was it? Zapata. Yeah, really isn't going to add to deniability at all. Invasion forces are invasion forces. You can't hide them.
Absolutely. And when you consider that you're talking about a 1,500-man brigade,
yeah,
and you're talking about planes, and you're talking about every kind of motor vehicle you can imagine on a half a dozen or so major ships and small craft and so on, and Kennedy expected this to be a quiet landing.
Yeah, I can't.
Yeah, that part is totally bizarre. I really think that they just had lost touch with reality at that point.
You're right.
That they had just become disconnected or disassociated from reality. And this is the more remarkable because, you know, Kennedy had been at war himself. He had seen how this huge machine of the Army and Navy and such, how it works. And it does not work quietly. It cannot work quietly. No, it does not.
The plan was they were going to come in at night.
Yeah, and that's remarkable too.
And when daylight came, withdraw.
Yeah, and that's
do it again.
I was going to say, for those of our listeners who don't, sort of follow, amphibious assaults, they're never done at night.
No,
because it's just logistically too. Even the military won't do it at night.
They wouldn't do it.
Yeah.
World War II.
Yeah, I mean, which is the obvious time to do it at night, but they wouldn't do it. They're like, no, it could be an absolute disaster. But here they get these guys. Yeah, oh, it's absolutely incredible in that way. So tell us a little bit about how the project was finally approved and then went forward.
It was, of course, approved by the president, which put kind of a magical kind of aura on it because, as you know, Dwight D. Eisenhower was a highly revered man. He was a military man associated with Normandy and all of this. So how could he possibly be wrong? That was the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then when Kennedy came in, he had, and to his credit, he had serious doubts about it. There's no question. But he was more or less bowled over by the experts. And, of course, you know the story that afterward he swore he was going to tear the CIA apart and just throw it to the winds, just splinter it.
Mm-hmm.
And the Joint Chiefs of Staff, he said at one point, with all their fruit salad pinned
right
on the front of their shirts and all this kind of thing, he had had it with these people just because they were the military experts.
Uh-huh.
He had stormed about Curtis LeMay one time after he had an argument with him that where do we get these people? These kind of people don't belong in civilized countries and so forth.
Yeah.
And he just went, he almost had an epileptic fit one time after talking with LeMay.
Uh-huh.
But in the first period, before all of this, he was enamored of these people. And I think there was something, you almost have the sense that Kennedy had, and I think Arthur Schlesinger bears this out as well, that he had almost a Midas touch, that whatever he touched worked.
Yeah.
And there was always the belief, even Eisenhower said this, that there was always American ingenuity and just good old luck.
Uh-huh.
And that when it really comes down to it, it'll work. And I think that the CIA and the dissidents in Cuba and whatever, and the Joint Chiefs as well, honestly felt that when it got down to the crunch time and if things were not really going well in the invasion, that Kennedy would not see us lose and that he would call in the military forces.
Right.
And he didn't.
Right. So they proceed with the invasion, and tell us a little bit about the night in which they disembarked.
The first night, April 17th, the first thing that was done was that there were small frogman teams, half a dozen or so, who would hit the beaches and would quietly set up marker lights that were seen only from the water, not seen from the beaches themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And they picked some secluded spots, and this would indicate the right channels to land and all of that kind of thing. Well, one of the first things Kennedy said when he approved the plan is no Americans to be involved.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the leader of each frogman team is American.
Mm-hmm.
So the first shots fired on the beaches, first firing, involved Americans.
Mm-hmm.
And Bissell had promised Kennedy that that would not happen.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they were discovered right at the very beginning. There were some firings, exchanges of fire with militiamen and a few others. And then to add almost a farcical kind of thing to this whole affair is that some of those who discovered them were workers building motel-like structures in a beach resort.
Mm-hmm.
All along the beaches, and they were up late that night partying on the beaches, so there were lights everywhere and mm-hmm. noise and singing and everything, people drinking and all of this, and here come the frogmen sneaking into the
mm-hmm.
beaches, and then, of course, firing of shots.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they were discovered, and the next thing is that the ships began coming in, and they were put on high speed to unload as quickly as possible.
And these are landing craft, correct? World War II style landing craft.
Yeah. And they're dumping everything you can imagine. And when daylight comes, they are not near done, as you can well guess.
Yeah.
And they're still there. They have not withdrawn like they were supposed to do. And the planes then began to arrive. One plane from Cuba's Air Force, another plane, and they began strafing and they began bombing. And, of course, there was firing back at them, but no planes whatsoever from the Cuban side, from the rebel side,
uh-huh.
because Kennedy had called all of that off.
Right. And
almost immediately before the invasion, he called it off.
Yes, he did.
Because the people on the beach understood that these planes were going to come.
Absolutely.
And they didn't realize that Kennedy had canceled them. Yeah.
Last second thing.
Yeah, and that's another thing I think that it's surprising Kennedy wouldn't know, having been in the Pacific Theater, that you don't invade places without air cover.
Yes.
Yeah. So they made certain of that at Normandy and everywhere else, that they
mm-hmm.
they totally dominated the skies. That there were no, in this case,
vulnerable.
Yes, they were very vulnerable. So then what happens?
We brought down a couple of the planes. I say we, the Americans working
uh-huh,
with
yeah.
the Cuban brigade, brought down a couple of the planes, but they were not able to disable Castro's Air Force. He had, we estimate, 18 or so planes, about a half a dozen Sea Furies and a half a dozen B-27s, but what he did have were jet trainers.
Mm-hmm.
But the experts had said these are of no count because they are training planes.
Mm-hmm.
They may be fast, but they can do no damage.
Mm-hmm.
Well, before the actual invasion took place, Cuba, either with the Russian technicians' help or the Cuban technicians on their own, armed the jet trainers with machine guns.
Mm-hmm.
And when they came in with lightning-like speed,
mm-hmm.
they were untouchable.
Mm-hmm.
They just ran through the area. They sank one of the big ships that the Cuban Brigade had, and this was in shark-infested waters,
mm-hmm.
which was another problem with this area.
Mm-hmm.
And a couple of other things happened where the men, some of these, were able to get out of the ships and run for shore if they weren't hit by the sharks.
Mm-hmm.
And this is one of the worst places in terms of coral reefs.
Mm-hmm.
They're like razor-sharp
mm-hmm.
reefs. And the CIA was not aware of this or
yeah.
certainly did not tell the people, and these things just ripped the men. It ripped the small craft,
mm-hmm.
and they were vulnerable with the guns from the planes flying overhead, and it was an absolute disaster.
Mm-hmm. And how does the, of course the press gets hold of this pretty fast, and
yes.
it appears in the papers. How does the Kennedy administration react?
Kennedy afterward, you mean after the whole thing was over?
No, I mean like the first day of the invasion or second day of the invasion when the headlines first appear.
Well, the
appear.
First thing, by the evening of the first day, there's already talk about evacuation.
Yeah.
And this is just a total shock because the communications between what's happening there, we had no one, the administration had no one there who could give a direct line of communication back to Washington.
Uh-huh.
So everything was arriving hours after the fact when it was too late to do anything.
Uh-huh.
And they began talking about evacuation. And to give you an idea of this, the Joint Chiefs Chair, Lemnitzer, said, well, there's no problem because all they have to do is escape into the mountains. They can
right.
just walk across the beaches and they're out of it. And as it turned out, he was not even aware of the mountains being so far away.
Yeah.
There was no way to escape. And when they got back off the beaches, it was, as I say, they were at the mercy of either the Zapata Swamp or to try to get out in the waters, and they're at the mercy of the sharks.
Mm-hmm.
And the Kennedy administration was not really aware of it in the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And so, was there an actual plan to take them off the beach then?
Oh, yes. Destroyers were sent in, and he kept them out of the territorial waters. And of course, at night when they tried to get in close, there were guns that from the tanks that Castro had amassed along the beach.
Uh-huh.
They had to stay out of the firing range, and they really could do that. And people pleaded with the president, called him out of a big ball, as it turned out.
Uh-huh.
We've got to do something about this. We have planes in the area. We have jets there just off the Cuban waters. We can send them in, give them air cover, and all of this kind of thing. And Kennedy absolutely refused to do it.
Uh-huh. And why did he refuse?
I think we get back to plausible deniability. He was afraid that it would show the American hand and we'll get involved. And the admiral stormed at him. He said, "We are involved, Mr. President." He used a few expletives in
uh-huh.
saying that. And that still did not get him.
Uh-huh. I see. So did...
What was the feeling then among the Joint Chiefs and, I guess, Bissell and the rest, that we were abandoning the Cubans there?
I think so. And I'm reading between the lines, but you almost get the feeling that, by God, they didn't want to come to us. They didn't want us to help them and so forth. So we wash our hands of this.
Uh-huh.
And I think they really did believe that when it got down to the final moment, the president, in frustration, desperation, exasperation, whatever, would turn to them and then they would bring in the military might.
Uh-huh.
And it just didn't happen.
Yeah. So in a sense, they never really believe. I mean, again, this is reading between the lines and probably saying
mm-hmm.
too much. They didn't really have great confidence that the invasion itself was going to work. They knew that it would serve as a pretext for American intervention itself.
I think one can read that interpretation in. Now, a lot of people would vastly disagree with that. They will point out that the Joint Chiefs said at the time that it had about a 50-50 chance or even less than that of working. But they still gave their silent approval.
That's just remarkable that they would say that, because, you know, anybody who studied military doctrine knows that you don't go into engagements with a 50-50 chance of winning.
No,
you just don't
absolutely.
Ever do that. Yeah, I mean, you have to have three times as many forces as the other side and, you know,
mm-hmm.
so much air superiority before you mm-hmm. do anything, and, you know, that they would approve something that, you know, and that Kennedy would sign off on it. It just really is, it's just quite a remarkable thing. So then after the thing was said and done and the invasion forces, they were captured, correct?
Yes.
For the most part, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And then what happened to them?
About 1,200 of them were captured and 100 or so plus were killed. And there were, of course, there were some heavy casualties on the Cuban side, no question. But he captured the 1,200. And what he did is he made it into a public spectacle, Castro
mm-hmm.
did.
Mm-hmm.
Castro had them put into the big gymnasium, a big auditorium
mm-hmm.
there in Havana. Had
mm-hmm.
them cleaned up, put there, and so forth, sitting in a group as if they're watching a basketball game
mm-hmm.
or whatever. And he berated them
mm-hmm.
over. It went on for hours
mm-hmm.
and hours.
Mm-hmm.
And they stood trial, and they were going to be convicted and all this kind of thing. But they were kept in prison until a deal was finally worked out about a year or so later, in which they were released by a ransom, if you want to call it that,
mm-hmm.
pharmaceutical supplies and so forth, millions of dollars worth and
mm-hmm.
so on were given to him, and they were released.
So we got all 1,200 of them out then?
We got them out, and the few Americans who were there, we had four Americans who actually died in the Bay of Pigs
mm-hmm.
invasion itself. And there's, I don't know if you know this story, but I found out some details after I had written the book. And I talked to a young woman. Well, I say young. She's in her 50s. That's a young woman.
Yes, it is.
Yes, it is. And her father was one of the pilots who was shot down during the course of the Bay of Pigs invasion. And it was all kept very hush-hush because, of course, no Americans were involved in it
right.
officially. And Robert Kennedy was deeply involved in keeping all of this quiet. And he was kept all these years until the 1970s in a freezer, the body was.
Holy cow.
And the daughter, this woman I talked with, had a lawsuit against Cuba that fell under the terrorism acts and so forth passed recently. And she sued him for everything that happened, got the body back in
uh-huh.
the 70s and had him properly buried in Alabama,
uh-huh.
and then carried on this lawsuit, and within the last year or so, won $20-plus million.
Really?
Yes.
Is that right?
And just a tremendous suit. I talked to her on the phone for a long time, a couple times. She called me about the book.
Uh-huh.
So there were four Americans killed in it. A couple of them, it's very obvious, including this her father, were executed point blank after being shot down.
Yeah,
that's right. So one of the most remarkable things I found in the book was even after this fiasco, and Kennedy, much to his credit, takes responsibility for it, they do not let go of the idea of overthrowing Castro at all.
This has been, the traditional story is that, boy, did he learn from that. and then the Cuban Missile Crisis drove home the point. So when you look at what actually happened right after this was over, Kennedy called in Maxwell Taylor and had him investigate what went wrong and basically what we can do to correct this.
Yeah.
And out of this comes not the idea of leaving Castro alone, but doing it better the next time.
Mm-hmm.
No frowning on assassination, no frowning on any way whatsoever to undermine him.
Mm-hmm.
And the Kennedy administration sets up a very hush-hush organization that is known as Operation Mongoose.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there have been many people who have argued what the purpose of it is, and some would say it was not assassination. Well, the purpose of it was clearly to eliminate Castro.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't believe they would have ever drawn the line at assassination. It was a blanket mandate to get rid of Castro. And the person who was put in charge of it was the liaison with John F. Kennedy, none other than Robert Kennedy.
Mm-hmm.
And the man who was the titular head of the whole thing was Edward Lansdale, who already had great fame as OSS and CIA and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And he said that there was never any statement made drawing a line or putting restraints on how you bring it about.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's pretty obvious that the elimination of Castro meant any way that was necessary to get rid of him.
Mm-hmm.
And then along came the Cuban Missile Crisis, and that ended the Operation Mongoose program.
Mm-hmm.
And the traditional program, or the traditional interpretation, is that this just scared the bejeebers out of the administration, and so they got rid of Operation Mongoose. Well, the documents indicate very strongly that they got rid of Operation Mongoose simply because it didn't work. And so the best thing now is to think of a more forthright way. And this is when Kennedy becomes first absolutely infuriated with Castro, the Kennedys, not just JFK, infuriated with Castro for welcoming the missiles, the missile sites, and they become even more determined in the course of the 13-day crisis over the Cuban missiles. In the course of this, they are also talking about getting rid of Castro.
Yeah, yeah.
So in the middle of this, they become, I think, obsessed with getting rid of Castro. Castro had some kind of knack of getting under the skin of the White House.
Yeah.
In particular, the Kennedys. They're both young, they're handsome, they have a lot of similarities, and yet they are repelled by each other.
Yeah.
It just seems like it's almost as if it's written in the stars that these two were going to go at each other.
Yeah, it's funny because I don't know a lot about Robert Kennedy's biography, but he strikes me as a man who held grudges.
Oh.
Really deep grudges. He never forgot a slight.
Mm-hmm.
And when he got this in his teeth, he was not going to let go of it.
That's right.
And then the remarkable thing, of course, is that Kennedy gets assassinated.
Yes.
And there are some amazing quotes in your book about how sort of top-ranking political leaders, including Johnson, immediately associate Kennedy's assassination with the attempts on Castro's lives.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe you could talk a little bit about that.
The first thing that I thought was really striking, of course, with the Bay of Pigs, the missile crisis, there is no laying down of the attempt to kill Castro.
Yeah.
There's no laying down of a military invasion.
Yeah.
Another plan is made to bring about a full-scale military invasion near Havana, near the Bay of Pigs, all of this kind of thing, and we would be leading the charge. Americans would be deeply involved in it. It would start off with another group of Cuban rebels, but we would be right there, ready to move as quickly as possible. And in the meantime, while all of this is going on, the CIA has made contact with a Cuban dissident who is in the top military circles of the Castro regime, a man named Rolando Cabela, who quickly picks up the CIA code name of Amlash. And he has become disenchanted with Castro because the revolution has gone off into a socialist direction, a communist direction, and so forth. And the man is really tipping on the edge, I think, of not really being balanced, to put it mildly. He's a really risky character to deal with, but he had an inside shot at Castro. I don't mean that literally. I mean he had an inside relationship with him. He knew him very well, and he could perhaps lead a coup. And so the CIA begins talking with him. And it's almost as if something out of a James Bond novel, because they are meeting in Paris, they're meeting in Stockholm, they're meeting in Latin America, various places and so forth, and they are actually meeting with him on the day Kennedy is assassinated in Paris. And they're ready to deliver a killing device to him, which he turns down. But they approve all kinds of military aid to him if he begins a coup.
Yeah, no, that's...
It's quite remarkable. And then you have a quote in there in which Johnson, after being told, apparently he didn't know much about these things, after being told that there was a series of attempts on Castro's life by the Kennedy administration, he concludes almost immediately that, I think the quote is something like, you know, Kennedy tried to get Castro, but Castro got him first.
Yes.
That's
and
just...
he firmly believed that and had a full-scale investigation and inquiry into the CIA itself. In other words, the CIA was investigating itself, but it came out with a pretty revealing report that is I've used extensively in writing the book. You have to be careful about certain things, no question.
Yeah.
But Johnson first stated publicly in the 1970s in a magazine article that came out that, my gosh, we had a murder incorporated in the White House.
Right.
I assume he was talking about the executive action capability.
Yeah, that was in the Atlantic Monthly. I have to give them a plug because I used to work there. So,
oh, well,
yeah.
Good.
Yeah.
Good. Well, they came out with that.
Uh-huh.
And then these documents show, and Califano's memoirs show this, that he said this in front of him and so forth, that... Castro got him first. Kennedy tried to get him, but Castro got him first.
Absolutely astounding. When I read that, I almost dropped the book. I could hardly believe it. It's really...
Well, me too, when I was going through the documents.
I bet it's true. So, anyway, you know, we've taken up so much of your time, and we really appreciate it, Howard. It's been absolutely fascinating talking to you. And
well,
again,
thank you.
For readers, the name of the book is The Bay of Pigs. I very much encourage you to go and purchase it and read it, because it's terrific. Let me ask you our traditional closing questions on this book in history, and that is, what are you working on now?
I have two projects in mind. I'm finishing up a book on here we are going into another century. I'm finishing up a book for North Carolina in a series on the Civil War, and I'm dealing with Union and Confederate foreign relations during the Civil War. And when I finish that, I'm going to go back with Oxford, and they've invited me to do another book for the Pivotal Moments series. It's on My Lai.
Oh, really? On My Lai?
So I'm going to be dealing with that.
No, that's, you know, it's so interesting you mentioned that, because I was, it's, My Lai is one of the ways I got into history myself. My my uncle was a fighter pilot in Vietnam. So I read a lot about Vietnam when I was growing up in the 60s, and I was very young, but and then the My Lai massacre occurred, and I saw it in the papers, and I wrote a little research project about it when I was, I must have been like 13 or something like that, 13 or 14, and it's funny because I'm interviewing in just a few weeks a fellow named James Wilbanks, who wrote a book called Abandoning Vietnam, and he served in Vietnam, and so I'm really looking forward to that interview myself. So you have to promise me when your book comes out that we can arrange an interview about it.
You have my promise.
Absolutely, because I really would want to talk to you about that. Absolutely. Well,
thank you.
Howard, thank you very much for being on the show. We really appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Marshall.
Okay.
It's been my pleasure, my delight.
All right, take care.
Thank you.
You've been listening to an interview with Howard Jones, author of The Bay of Pigs. I'm Marshall Poe, the host of New Books in History, and I hope you have a good week.